parasites. She says they're now fat and healthy. Officials at the clinic in Urbana say the Alton Clinic is a licensed rehabilitation center experienced in raising and releasing orphan bobcats. In sports, Brandon Bolling may get Victor Stahlberg's spot in the Chicago Blackhawks lineup for Game 1 of tonight's Stanley Cup Finals. Stahlberg wasn't part of any of the top four lines at practice yesterday. Bolling could give the Blackhawks a bigger presence against the Boston Bruins. Stahlberg has no goals and three assists in the postseason. Game 1 tonight is at the United Center. Baseball, Jake Westbrook of the St. Louis Cardinals is scheduled to come off the disabled list and start Friday night in Miami. The right-hander has been out of action for more than a month with elbow inflammation. Cards continue their series with the Mets tonight in New York. Cubs news, Ian Stewart has apologized for his Twitter rant. The Cubs have suspended the AAA infielder without pay after he tweeted that manager Dale Swain doesn't like him and the team will probably keep him in the minors all season. Stewart is making $2 million this year, but got hurt in spring training and hasn't played in the majors. The Cubs, weather permitting, will host Cincinnati again this afternoon at Wrigley Field. And the White Sox host Toronto again tonight. Chris Sale tries for his sixth victory of the season against Ismael Rogers of the Blue Jays. I'm Jeff Bossert, Illinois Public Media News.
Programs on WILL are made possible by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
It's 12:39. Partly to mostly sunny skies and light winds prevailed across central and southeast Illinois through the morning hours. By late morning, temperatures across the area were mostly in the low to mid-80s, ranging from 82 at Galesburg to 85 at Lincoln. A strong storm system will push across the Midwest this afternoon. That will bring a good chance of thunderstorms to the region. Severe thunderstorms are likely across much of Illinois, Indiana, southern Wisconsin, eastern Iowa, and northeast Missouri. Strong, damaging winds appear to be the greatest severe weather threat. High temperatures will range from the mid-70s across Wisconsin and northwest Iowa to the mid-90s south of Interstate 70. The rest of today around Champaign-Urbana, hot and humid, partly sunny skies, 50% chance of showers this afternoon. Some could be severe. The high 92 degrees, wind gusts up to 25 miles an hour. We'll also have heat index readings of 100 to 105. Showers and thunderstorms tonight, a chance of severe storms this evening. The low 65 degrees, wind gusts up to 20 miles an hour. Mostly sunny skies tomorrow, not as warm, the high around 78 degrees. Mostly clear skies Thursday night with a low of 55. Mostly sunny skies Friday with a high of 78. Partly cloudy Friday night with a low of 60 degrees. Partly sunny Saturday, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high around 82. And Saturday night and Sunday, showers are likely with a low of 68, the high 82. Sunday night and Monday, mostly cloudy, a chance of rain, the low around 68, the high 82. Right now, temperatures in the area, we'll look over at Bloomington. We have 86 degrees. Danville, 90 degrees. Decatur, 89. At Willard Airport, it's 89 degrees. And on Friends Plaza in Urbana, 87 degrees.
WILL programs are made possible by the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, presenting Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors and Macbeth, plus Failure, a Love Story by Philip Dawkins from July 6th through August 10th at Ewing Manor in Bloomington. Ticket information is available at thefestival.org or 309-438-2535.
U.S. Supreme Court justices are set to rule on the issue of same-sex marriage this month. University of Illinois at Springfield Associate Professor Jason Pearson has published a book called Same-Sex Marriage in the United States, The Road to the Supreme Court. He talked with Illinois Public Radio's Sean Crawford to talk more about this closely watched topic and pending decision.
Jason, this is a landmark moment, I would think, for people on both sides of this issue.
Yeah, it's the first time that the U.S. Supreme Court has directly addressed the issue of marriage equality, same-sex marriage. They did so indirectly in the early 70s and kind of rejected a challenge to ban some same-sex marriage, but not they didn't do it in a way that left any jurisprudence to really go from substantially. So this is the first time that in the modern era, in the last couple of decades, the Supreme Court has directly grappled with the issue. And what it does would certainly affect the conversation about same-sex marriage. The court certainly probably will not end the conversation about same-sex marriage in the country.
Well, talk about the cases, if you could, that are before the court, and exactly, you know, what are the issues at play here?
Right. Well, there are two cases that have been appealed to the court, that the court heard oral arguments a few months ago back in March and will rule very likely in the next few weeks. One is from California, a challenge to the constitutionality of Proposition 8, which was a voter-approved initiative that banned same-sex marriage in California. That was approved pretty narrowly by a vote of 52-48. It was a shock to many same-sex marriage advocates that California would have passed that in 2008, but they did. And then a year or two later, folks went to federal court to try to challenge that and say it was unconstitutional under the constitutional provision of the Equal Protection Clause, saying that the ban on same-sex marriage in California violates equal protection. The second case is a bit of a different issue, and that's a challenge to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which was enacted in 1996. That also is being challenged on equal protection grounds, but there are also some federalism questions there, whether or not Congress should be regulating marriage, an issue that's traditionally left up to the states to regulate and implement.
Your book really is a recap of how this all got to this point, too. I mean, not just the legal fights, but also the grassroots efforts, the religious battles that have taken place over this.
Absolutely. And this has been going on for almost 40 years now. And, you know, the first sincere efforts to achieve marriage equality happened in the 1970s. And there were a lot of couples that went to court to sue on the basis of their denial of marriage licenses. Many people went to city clerks and county clerks to get married and were denied. Legally, the process didn't get very far. Courts typically dismissed those challenges out of hand pretty quickly in the 1970s. Things accelerated quite significantly in the early 1990s and 1993 when the Hawaii Supreme Court ruled famously that they thought that their state constitution probably required same-sex marriage. And that set off the national conversation that we know now that has been going on for the past couple decades. And that led to the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996 because Congress realized that if people could get married in a state like Hawaii, although marriage was never legalized in Hawaii as a footnote, but it looked like it might be, and Congress thought, well, we don't like same-sex marriage, so we want to make sure that states don't have to recognize it, and we want to make sure the federal government doesn't have to recognize same-sex marriages performed in any state that might decide to allow same-sex marriages.
We're talking with University of Illinois Springfield professor Jason Pearson. He's published a book called Same-Sex Marriage in the United States, The Road to the Supreme Court. Now, no matter what the court does, we have states out there still looking, like Illinois, whether or not they want to legalize same-sex marriage. You sort of seem to indicate, from what I could tell, that that the court may not have a dramatic effect on what some of these states do.
Yes.
At least in the near term.
In the near term. Unless the court rules in the most aggressive fashion it could, and that's unlikely given the current makeup of the court, its temperament, how it typically deals with new issues like this or relatively new issues. Most people, because it could say, especially in the Prop 8 case, that same-sex marriage is required under the U.S. Constitution and therefore it would mandate all states to have it. That is probably unlikely. The most likely scenario is that they invoke some legal procedural maneuvers to kick the issue of Prop 8 back to California and make it a California-only issue, or maybe just strike it down for California, not the rest of the states. That would then leave the situation to still be decided state by state, which means Illinois would still have to grapple with the issue and other states. And what we've seen the past couple of years is that states that have been more liberal and democratic, especially where Democrats can control all the levers of power, we've seen a movement towards civil unions and same-sex marriage quite quickly. Once it used to be 5, 10 years ago, Democrats were probably in their gut sympathetic to same-sex marriage, but were worried about the political ramifications. But now the Democratic Party is pretty much on board and has pushed the policy through many states in the past couple of years.
In some of those states, too, it's being looked at as a civil rights issue. But it seems in some other states, maybe especially in some southern states and other places, it's often viewed as a religious issue, a freedom of religion issue to say, we don't want this. We don't want, you know, churches to have to recognize, you know, same-sex couples, things like that. I mean, so it really is quite a divide here.
Yes, and the religious question is a big one, and is probably the reason why the United States has struggled with the issue more than other similar countries like Canada or many European countries that have moved much more quickly and uniformly toward marriage equality. On the religious freedom question, it's interesting because that has really come up more recently The first religious-based objection to same-sex marriage was much more theological, that it was sinful and the government shouldn't recognize it, or that marriage was a certain theological construction between for men and women for procreation. As that directly theological argument has lost some clout, and as people have seen it maybe as homophobic or, you know, trying to judge people in a certain way, opponents of marriage equality have moved toward the religious freedom argument, saying, well, if same-sex marriage exists, it will violate our rights to conscience. I think there are a lot of complications with that argument because it also would implicate all kinds of anti-discrimination laws for all kinds of factors, but it has been brought up prominently. And it's not unrelated that in the South, which is much more – where religiosity has much more influence on politics, there really are no pro-marriage equality policies or even civil unions. The only region of the country where there's nothing is in the deep South, you know, the Northeast, the Midwest, West Coast, Southwest. States in those regions have seen civil unions, domestic partnerships, marriage equality. In the South, it's pretty bleak in terms of that policy perspective of same-sex marriage. So religion is a big part of the story.
You mentioned earlier how the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled back in the early 70s but had not really done anything in almost 40 years. Has that hurt the movement? Has that, you know, delayed this movement somewhat?
Probably not, because activists for same-sex marriage have avoided the Supreme Court for most of that period of time because they knew that the federal courts were probably trending in a more conservative direction given the presidencies of Reagan and Bush and the Bushes in the 80s and 90s and the early 2000s. So, and they thought that state courts were probably more liberal in some pockets. And so they chose litigation in more favorable forms like Hawaii or Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Iowa even. So they targeted state judiciaries that were going to be sympathetic toward arguments in favor of same-sex marriage, trying to avoid the federal courts. It's only in the last 5 years or so, even less than that, that same-sex marriage advocates have looked to the federal courts as a favorable form. And in fact, the Prop 8 case, which was filed in federal court, was opposed initially by most of the national LGBT rights groups because they thought the federal courts, the Supreme Court, wasn't ready to rule in favor of same-sex marriage, and they didn't want that litigation. They were much more inclined to support the Defense of Marriage Act challenges because that's in some ways an easier case for the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court takes on Congress all the time and routinely strikes down laws of Congress. They're probably less likely to take on the 30 states that have constitutional bans on same-sex marriage, and that's where the Prop 8 case is a little bit more tricky politically and legally for the court from the perspective of same-sex marriage advocates.
University of Illinois Springfield Associate Professor Jason Pearson is the author of Same-Sex Marriage in the United States, The Road to the Supreme Court. He talked with Illinois Public Radio's Sean Crawford.
WILO programming is made possible by Kranert Center for the Performing Arts, announcing the 2013-2014 season featuring El Nora, the Guitar Festival, Hungarian State Folk Ensemble Gypsy Romance, Meredith Monk on behalf of Nature, the Moscow Festival Ballet, and more. Tickets are on sale Saturday, August 10th at 10 a.m.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 12th of June, 2013. It's the birthday of Juna Barnes, born in Cornwall-on-Hudson, New York in 1892. She was a reporter, starting out writing articles for Vanity Fair and The New Yorker, then became part of a bohemian scene in Greenwich Village. She published an early collection of poems and drawings called The Book of Repulsive Women. She moved to Paris in the 20s and became friends with writers there, including Eliot, Gertrude Stein, James Joyce. And after reading Joyce's Ulysses, she said, "I shall never write another line. Who has the nerve to after that?" But almost 15 years later, she published Nightwood, an experimental novel about a woman named Nora Flood, her love affairs, and her spiritual advisor, a transvestite named Dr. O'Connor. The book was rejected by all the American publishers she submitted it to, but T.S. Eliot loved it, so he published it himself and wrote an introduction. It had a great influence on many later experimental writers of the 50s and 60s, and it's become a cult favorite. For the last 42 years of her life, Juna Barnes lived as a recluse in New York City. Writers came to pay homage to her, but she sent them away. Her neighbor, E.E. Cummings, used to check on her by yelling out his window. She spent her last 30 years working on a long poem that was found in her apartment when she died. In 1973, she told her editor, "It's terrible to outlive your own generation." It's the birthday of Anne Frank, born in Frankfurt, Germany in 1929. She received a diary as a present on her 13th birthday and immediately began writing in it. When her older sister Margot got notice to report to a Jewish work camp, the Franks went into hiding in Amsterdam along with four other people, living there in the annex for 2 years. Her earliest journal entries are about her grades and classmates. She wrote that since she did not have any close friends, she would treat her diary as though it were a close friend, and she began addressing it by the imaginary name of Kitty. She wrote to her diary, "I hope I shall be able to confide in you completely, as I never have been able to do in anyone before, and I hope that you will be a great support and comfort to me." Anne Frank wrote in her diary regularly while she was in hiding, but she didn't just write about the Nazi persecution or the experience of living in secret. She also wrote about the ordinary details of her adolescent life, how much she hated potatoes and how her older sister was clearly her parents' favorite. On August 4th, 1944, the annex